This year is brought to you by TorahWeb.org.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Galler. Bereshus Marenu, Rav Tursky Shlita, Bereshus, the other Rabbanim, Rabbi Abramowitz and Rabbi Finkelstein. I want to also thank Rav Judah for arranging this morning's program. As frightening as it is to speak in front of Rav Tursky, it's still always a great pleasure to come to West Hempstead and to see so many friends, and that's why I keep coming back, because it's like a home crowd. It's all my friends, so it's always wonderful to be together with you, especially to share Torah together with you. I want to share a perspective on our approach, or our, I should say, continuing approach to what is happening in Klal Yisrael at this time, where we had a mahalich at the beginning of the war after October 7th, and as things progress, things are changing by the day. I don't know if you saw the news this morning of a massive withdrawal from Gaza. Things are changing by the day. And I think as things evolve, our approach as to what the proper way to behave as a Jew in Chutz La'aretz needs to evolve as well. And we need to figure out what points to emphasize and what points to de-emphasize, as our Avodas Hashem always demands. There are X number of values that we have to live up to, and so at some points we emphasize certain values and de-emphasize others, and it's always important to take the temperature a little bit and to see what the proper approach should be. But we're at the time of the year as we're leading up to Pesach, we're coming up, we just spent Rosh Chodesh yesterday, so let's talk a little bit about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And let's go back to the very, very beginning, or almost the beginning, of the story. When Moshe Rabbeinu was born, you know, there's a word in Chumash that's a little bit difficult, or I always found somewhat difficult to translate. When I was a kid, when I was a little boy in Yeshiva of South Shore, and they were teaching us Chumash, and they translated the words of Chumash, they did an excellent job. And I was able to read the Psukim and to translate all the words as I was taught to translate them. But there were certain words that, even given the translation, and even repeating the words as a child, I didn't really know what they meant. Right? For example, I was always taught that when someone is matzachein, what does that mean? They found favor. Now, I knew what a favor was. A favor is something you do for somebody else when they ask you for a favor. I had no idea what it means to find favor. Where do you find favors? I had no idea what the word meant, because it's just a word that I would never use in that context. My children now know that when they started learning Chumash, I would always challenge them on that. Say, what does it mean to find favor? I would say, you know that friend you had in camp that you were like really close with in camp, but he lives in like Boston or somewhere, somewhere far away, so you never really get to connect with him, but you know that you'd be best friends with him if he was right. That's chen, right? That's some special quality. One of my kids is in Eretz Yisrael this year, and he said the guy with chen came, because I used to give an example of a friend of mine. He said, Rabbi Joel came, the guy from Cleveland, the guy with chen, he's here. So there's another word that appears. And again, I always knew how to translate. I was never quite sure what the word means. And the word is hine. How do we translate hine? Behold. I don't know, so behold. I never in my life, I think, in conversational English, used the word behold. I probably would have been made fun of if I did. I don't recall ever using such a word. And yet, in Parsha Shmos, Bas Paro opens up a basket, vihine nar boche. And behold, there is a child that is crying. Later on, Moshe goes out to survey the situation, what's going on in Mitzrayim. And once again, vihine, shnei anashim ivrim, that there are two Jewish people that are fighting with each other. Which is even all the more curious, because it's not even the first fight that he saw. A little bit earlier, he saw a fight, and there was no vihine. Vayar ish mitzri, makeh ish ivrim. He saw that an ish mitzri was beating up an ish ivri. And there was no hine. So what exactly are we supposed to take from this word? Every word of the Torah is so precious. What are we supposed to take from this word, hine? Another question. Bas Paro finds Moshe Rabbeinu, or finds little baby Moshe at that time. The Chumash tells us that she saw the baby was crying. That's all the Chumash tells us, that she saw that he was crying. Vatomer miyaldei ha'ivrimzeh. And she said, ooh, this must be a Jewish baby. Now, Chazal have all sorts of interpretations of what gave it away that he was a Jewish baby. On a simple Pshuto Shel Mikra reading, the Chumash level, she saw he was crying, and then he was Jewish. Do non-Jewish babies not cry? I would imagine the birth rates would be much. You put no tuition and no crying, I would imagine the birth rates would be much, much higher among non-Jews if non-Jewish babies didn't cry. There must be something else that gave away that he was a Jewish baby. Finally, there are certain people who we tend to emphasize in our recounting of various biblical events. And there are certain people who, for whatever reason, when we recount the story, we tend to de-emphasize, even though the Chumash seems to talk a lot about them. You know, if you open up Sefer Shemos, Parsha Shemos, and you go through Perek Hei of Sefer Shemos, there is a group of people that are emphasized significantly in that story, and I would bet at most of our Siddurim, we barely mention them. You won't hear a single Dvar Torah about them, or maybe one. And that is the Jewish taskmasters, right? It's abundantly clear that they were involved. The Chumash tells us a lot about them. It's not abundantly clear why they're so important to the story of Geula. Torah tells us Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro. He requests the freedom of the Jewish people. Paro doesn't only deny the request, but he adds a quota and he stops providing the necessary supplies. He makes things much, much worse for the people. The Jewish taskmasters were beaten for the inevitable shortfall that the people were unable to produce. Taskmasters go to complain to Paro. The demands are too great. It's not realistic. You can't do this. You can't expect this of the people. He's not at all sympathetic to them. And then, Vayiru Shotri B'nei Yisrael Osam Bara Lemar, that the Shotrim saw, these taskmasters saw how terrible it was for the Jewish people, and they ran into Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen. On their way out of the palace, they voiced their grievances. The Rav Matzio Salman Zichron of Racha points out that last pasuk is in the wrong place. Meaning the idea of seeing Barah should have been several psukim earlier, as soon as the unreasonable demands were placed. Right, the unreasonable demands were placed right there. They see Barah, they see how terrible it is. They see the horrible situation. Why would the Chumash wait until after they go and they complain about it and they're rejected again, and then they run into Moshe and Aaron, and then they finally see the Ra. The Ra was there the whole time. The Ra was evident the whole time. So I'll share with you one simple idea from Rav Matzio Salomon that helps to answer these questions and hopefully can give us a little bit of hadracha at this time. Rav Matzio was, of course, Zichron Levracha, was the Lakewood Mashkiach, passed away not that long ago, and he quoted from his Rebbe, Rav Elia Lapian Zatzal, that there were two ways that Geula can come. The first is the direct way, that, you know, we earn enough sechuyos, we do enough mitzvos, and we are privileged to have Geula. But then there's another method that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could bring the Geula through. And it's based on a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos. The Gemara tells us in Shabbos Daf Kufnun Aleph, that when a person expresses rachmanus for others, so then we're going to be the recipients of rachmanus from the Ribono Shel Olam. And it's going to take great rachamei shemayim, absent the requisite number of zechuyos that we need, it will take great rachamei shemayim in order to earn geula. How do we harness that rachamei shemayim? How do we earn that rachamei shemayim? By being merachim alabrios, meaning essentially, sometimes Rav Elia Lapian writes, we suffer because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is punishing us, and sometimes we suffer because Hashem is trying to elicit a response of rachmanus. He wants to see the rachmanus that the Jewish people, one of our trademarks, that we are rachmanim, of our three trademarks, rachmanim, b'ashanim, gomlei, chasadim, he wants to see that trademark rachmanus that we have. If Jews can show that they feel the pain of other Jewish people as if it were their own, if Jews can show that they found the pain unbearable, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu would feel that pain also unbearable, and it would trigger a geula. Rashi tells us there's a mesorah in Klal Yisrael, that there was a mesorah in Klal Yisrael, that the shaliach to bring the geula is going to come with magic words. Pakod Yifkod, the first guy to say that, he's the Goel. He's the one that's going to lead the Geula. And it's a very troubling Rashi, because if they all knew that those were the magic words, then what's to stop? We have no shortage of false messiahs in history, right? So what's to stop anyone from just coming with magic words and saying Pakod Yifkod and then being celebrated as a Goel? How do you know? If they didn't know, then what's the use of magic words if nobody knew the magic words? So what does it mean exactly? So the Kutzker explains that Pakod means to remember. but doesn't mean that, Hebrew language is so nuanced. A lot of times you have two different words that are translated the same way in English. But they obviously mean something different, otherwise there wouldn't be two Hebrew words for it. Zachar means to remember. Pakod means to remember. But there's a difference between Zechira and Pekida, he says. For example, I remember what I ate for lunch yesterday. Right? Challah and potato kugel, grilled chicken, standard Jewish fare. Right? Gefilte fish. I think that was it. Challah, of course. I remember what I ate for lunch yesterday. Zechira. I have a Zechira of what I ate. Pakod, says the Kotzker, is a memory that's laden with emotion. You know, it's the memory of the song that your wife walked down to the aisle with. I have no idea what song my wife walked down, but you know, there are people that talks to, that music talks to them in that way, that they'll never forget, that there's a certain emotion that it carries with it. And the Kotzker says that the siman wasn't just about a magic word or a secret phrase. It was a person who comes and seems to truly care. Geula comes when the person who sets the tone for the rest of Klal Yisrael has a deep emotional connection to each and every member of Klal Yisrael. And he's genuinely merachim al abrios. In fact, it's the first message HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Moshe Rabbeinu when they first met, so to speak. HaKadosh Baruch Hu meets Moshe Rabbeinu at the Sinai before he even opens his mouth, before Hashem says anything to Moshe Rabbeinu, he appears in this lowly Sinai. And Rashi explains why in a lowly sne, v'lo ilon acher, not in a cedar tree, not in some large, impressive tree, mishum imo anochi b'tzara. The first, just the visual that Moshe Rabbeinu has, of a sne bor be'esh, of a sne that's, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he realizes that that's the shechina by the sne, he realizes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also suffering. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is imo anochi b'tzara, that he's feeling our pain. And the more Hashem feels the pain, the closer Geula is. The Altar of Kelim has the following interesting idea. You know, the Mishnah goes through 48 kinyanim of Torah, 48 ways to achieve in Torah. And among the 48 kinyanim of Torah is Nosei Ba'olim Chaveiro. So the Altar asks, Nosei Ba'ol, it's a great midah. It seems to have very little to do with actual accomplishment in Torah. You tell me Hasmada is a Kinyan Torah, of course. Having good Chavrusa, yeah, makes sense. A good Rebbe, that leads to success. Nosei Ba'ol, how does that help you understand the Tshuvas Rebbe Akiva Eiger? The fact that I'm concerned about other people. How does that help me when I open up a Tshuvas Rebbe Akiva Eiger? How does that help me understand? Someone once commented that if you don't believe in Yeridas Hadoros, if you think that our generation is just as smart as any other generation, take a Tshuvas Rebbe Akiva Eiger off the shelf, just open up to any Tshuva, and just sit and learn for a few minutes. It won't take long for you to believe in Yeridas Hadoros. Right? That Jews like that don't walk the face of this earth anymore. So how does that help? Nosei Ba'olim Chaveiro, says the Altar, it's a remarkable vart when you think about it. It says, the Torah is absolute emes. Moshe emes, v'toraso emes. In order for a person to excel in Torah, he has to have a healthy relationship with emes. I had a math teacher when I was in high school, Rabbi Fine, and I remember one of the boys in the class said, I hate math. And Rabbi Fine got very angry at him. And he said, you can't hate math, because if you hate math, you're ultimately going to hate Torah. And he said, Mehechitesi. I don't think he said it in those words, but he said, Mehechitesi. So he said, because 2 plus 2 equals 4, that's MS. The study of math is the study of MS. And if you dislike things that are MS, it's going to lead you to a life of sheker. You're going to ultimately dislike Torah. If you have a loose relationship with MS, you're not going to have a positive relationship with Torah either. And the Altar writes, the Altar from Kelim writes, I saw this quoted by Rav Yerucham Olshin, like Rosh Shiva, that a self-absorbed person, someone who suffers from too much ahavas atzmo, who's too inner-focused, has reached, and the Altar's Lashon is, the tachlis koach hasheker. It's the ultimate in sheker. Now, at first, it doesn't compute, because I'm focused on myself, that's the tachlis koach hasheker. How does my focus on myself relate to sheker? But he says a person who sees only himself has such a narrow view of the world, where he translates all world events through his own desires, through his own interests, through his own ambitions. This is the tachlis koach hasheker, the worst kind of sheker. only somebody who can see things through the eyes of other people, who's nosei ba'ol im chavero, can have the relationship with MS that's necessary to achieve in learning, can have a healthy relationship with MS. Because MS means that I'm able to see beyond what's right in front of me. I'm able to see the whole picture. And if I can only see things the way I would like to see them, well, then that's the tachlis koach hashakra. We see it in our discourse nowadays, political discourse nowadays. In America, bein in Eretz Yisrael. That everyone just attaches themselves to the things that they want to hear. And when you attach yourself only to the things that you want to hear, only to the stations that have your viewpoint in that, so you're just narrowing your view even further and further and further. And ultimately, people are unable to appreciate anything beyond whatever's in our most narrow viewpoint. Rabbi Rav Shachter often points out that people who think of themselves too much will often make the most absurd arguments to defend their behavior. And they seem to believe what they're saying because they're seeing things from the tachlis koach hashaker. And with this fundamental idea of no se ba'ol, we can answer all the questions that we began with, and I'd like to then share with you perhaps three messages for this time in particular. But let's first answer the questions. The word hine, I hope it's not too irreverent for me to say, but maybe better than a word to translate hine, an emoji might be a better translation of hine. Meaning the shocked emoji, like, wasn't expecting that, like total surprise. Hine is something that was completely v'hine na'ar bocha. The Baal HaTurim writes, Moshe wasn't a na'ar at that point. Moshe was a tinok, he was a baby. It's a funny word to use to describe him as a na'ar. And it wouldn't be a surprise that a baby was crying. Babies cry. That's what babies do. Egyptian babies cry and Jewish babies cry. Right? Babies cry. The Baal HaTurim writes, v'hine na'ar bocha. Ze Aharon, shenichaso etzalateva. It wasn't the boy in the box that was crying. It was the boy standing off to the side that was crying. It was Aaron HaKohen that was crying. Nar Bochad, Baal HaTurim of course has a gematria. Be gematria, ze Aaron HaKohen. She was surprised to see that there was somebody else that cared so much. She was surprised to see that there was someone else standing off to the side that was present. It was Aaron crying over the fate of his brother. When she saw that there was somebody crying for the baby, she understood, Ki mialdei ha'ivrim zeh. The Jews will always have another Jew crying for them. Ki mialdei ha'ivrim zeh. It has to be a Jewish child. The Jewish people are rachmanim. And later on, Moshe Rabbeinu grew up and he left the palace and he wanted to see what Golus and Sheba look like outside of the walls of the palace. And there are only two descriptions of the centuries of Golus Mitzrayim. Two descriptions of Moshe Rabbeinu's entire experience of what he saw before he started his mission. He saw first Ish Mitzri Makeh Ish Ivri. There's no Hine. That's what Golus is. Ish Mitzri is Makeh Ish Ivri. One would imagine that's what he expected to see. But then he goes out again, Vihine, Shnei Anashim Ivrim. There are two Jewish people that are fighting with each other. That's shocking to him. First thing he saw was the definition of Galus. The second thing he saw was the explanation for Galus. He saw what Galus is, and he saw why Galus happens on his two trips out of the palace. Rav Eliyahu Lapian explains that the Shotrim were the ones who actually triggered the Geula. The Chumash puts emphasis on the Shotrim. The Torah HaKadosha puts emphasis on the Shotrim because it's their actions that triggered the Geula. Rashi explains they didn't have to get beaten. All they had to do was report to the Egyptians which workers produced what, and the workers themselves who fell short of their quotas, they were going to get beaten. The Shotrim saw the suffering of these laborers and how they were being driven beyond the limits of human endurance. And they couldn't bear to watch them suffer more than they already have. So the Shotrim wouldn't hand over their lists. And they took the beating instead. That act of extreme empathy activated HaKadosh Baruch Hu's midah of extreme empathy. Kala merachem al brios, merachem lalav, min hashamayim. And that's where Geula was set into motion. That's why the Torah tells us how they saw Bira which leads directly into HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying, Atatira Sheres Elaparo. It juxtaposes the pasuk of them seeing Berah, them seeing the terrible things that were happening, because it meant something to them, and that directly leads into Hashem saying, now you're going to see what I'm going to do to Paro. Because that's what triggered the whole thing. You know, we don't know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in mind with any given event, or any given tragedy, or any given series of events, or any given tzkufa in history. But we are permitted to use Chumash as a guide, to use history as a guide, to use the Torah as a guide. Sometimes Hashem is looking to bring out the sense of empathy that's hidden within us in order to trigger great things for the Jewish people. And that brings me to our topic. I forgot the exact title. It was kind of long. But something about empathy and, I think, unless I'm totally off base, yes. Can we really feel what people in Eretz Yisrael are going through? Of course not. It's absurd to think that we can. If you don't have a child that was just fighting in Gaza for 5 months, that you didn't, that every knock on the door was frightening. I mentioned in the past, I have a friend who lives in Beit Shemesh. He said when he knocks on people's doors, he does it in a tune, because he doesn't want to scare anyone for even that moment, because he knows everyone's heart skips a beat when there's a knock on the door. So he just plays a song on the door, so that they won't even have to think for a second, because mistumba, that's not how the army comes. Can we relate to that experience if we don't have a child that's fighting? You know, as affected as we are by experience here, it's just not the same. Even in Eretz Yisrael, obviously it's different for a family of a captive or a fallen soldier than for a family of an active soldier, different yet for a family of a wounded soldier, different yet for a family of a soldier in non-combat, different depending where you live, in the north, in the south. It's a different experience for everybody. So I want to share with you three messages of what we Jews in Chutz Laretz, Dafka at this point, and maybe some of these things apply more than just at this point. But three takeaways. The first message, I think, is we should be doing something different. Part of Nosei Ba'ol means that the way we experience luxury, the way we experience the easiness of life in Chutz Laretz, and I know a rise in anti-Semitism and everything else, but the way we experience our, halach yelech of yom yom, of every day, has to be adjusted in some way. My friend Rabbi Shai Shachter told me he got a shayla he told me to ask his father the following shayla right before Purim. A woman had called and said that on October 8th, she made a commitment that she's never going to drink wine as long as the war is going on, except for Shabbos and Yantif. She says she's not a big drinker to begin with, but if there's a little extra wine from Kiddush on Shabbos, they'll have it with Sunday night with dinner. Or if she goes out to her husband to a restaurant with her husband, they would order a glass of wine. And she wanted to know, Purim was coming up, should she have a little bit of wine at her Purim Suda? Again, she wasn't going to drink so much wine anyway, but a little bit of wine at the Purim Suda. Is that included? So Rabbi Shai Shachter says, just pay attention to the questions. Sometimes the questions are so much more important than the answers. Here's a woman that decided right off the bat, something has to change. If everyone is living a certain way in Eretz Yisrael, I'm not going to live like them. I will never be like, I'm not going to have that shared experience. But at least Nosei Ba'ol a little bit. One of the Rebbeim and one of the local yeshivas in Darche Torah related a story of a fifth grader who had been learning well, and he earned a prize. He earned a prize package filled with all sorts of goodies. So his mother called the yeshiva and said that the boy had decided that even though he was going to drink the soda, because he did work for that reward, so he wanted the soda that he got, the other stuff he was going to put aside until after the war. He felt it was inappropriate to indulge when so many people are suffering. A fifth grader. It's Nosei Ba'ol, just something, that there should be something, some change in the way we experience. Again, everyone in their own way. I'm not here to tell you exactly what and how, but something to be Nosei Ba'ol. Second message is to be a source of strength to people who are closer to the inside. I was talking to the father of a fallen chayal, and he told me that he draws all of his strength from his wife. he says she's the one with emunah and bitachon. I'm just riding her coattails. That's the way of the Jewish people. Behind every picture, it's important to realize, behind every picture, every sickening picture that makes your stomach drop of a young man that you see on whatever your news source is, Yeshiva World, whatever, when you open up in the morning and you see that there's another picture of someone who had fallen, you have to, there's a mother behind that, there's sometimes a wife behind that, there are sometimes Yisomim dealing with incomprehensible loss. And, you know, to me, it's amazing. Have you heard a single person? Many of these people are Olim. They made the choice to move to Eretz Yisrael. They weren't born there. And yet, I haven't heard a single person say, why did we do this? This was such a mistake. Who needs this? What are we doing this for? To the contrary, the greatest nechama, a mother of a fallen soldier called me or texted me, and she said, the group from your shul was just here, and the biggest nechama I had was that two of them were going to look for apartments because they're making aliyah. They had to leave our meeting early to go look for apartments. Biggest nechama. According to some Rishonim, the final and ultimate test of Avraham Avinu was not the Akedah. It was dealing with Ephron and finding a burial place for Sarah in the aftermath of the Akedah. Now, why was that such a great test? Because someone was trying to overcharge him for a lousy piece of property? You know, what seemed like a useless piece of property for anything else other than Kavura? If you Google funerals overcharging, a lot will come up, right? Meaning that there are people that this is how they make their money. They'll say, look, do you want to get a regular pine casket or do you want one with air conditioning and cushions and whatever? Do you really love your mom? Right, and they'll people. There's price gouging like crazy. Avraham Avinu was not the first and was not the last that has to deal with this kind of thing, in burying somebody. I always thought that the pshat was, I must have seen it somewhere. I just don't remember where. That the pshat was that all of the other 9 nisyonos that Avraham Avinu went through, he knew that at the end of the day, he was going to be able to come home, and he was going to be able to say, Sarah, you're not going to believe the day I just had. He would have someone to relate to, someone to unload on, someone to talk to, someone who understands him, someone to have that shared experience with him. This was the first time he was going through. Now, the Akedah, he didn't have Sarah, but he didn't know that yet. This was the first time he was going through a Nisayon where he knew, as he was going through the Nisayon, at the end of the day, there's not going to be someone to support him. We can be an enormous source of strength for people just by being present. You know, it's not, I assume, even though maybe I'm being big shame over here, that most people here have smartphones, right? You can set an alarm, I'm told. I have a smartphone too. You can set an alarm, a daily alarm, a weekly alarm, reminding you everyone here has somebody that's closer to the situation, someone who lives in Eretz Yisrael, someone who has a child in the army, someone. So just once a week, check in, thinking about you, davening for your son every day, davening for your daughter every day, davening for you every day. And it should be true. We should be davening every day. And third, we have to have a sense of shared mission and a sense of shared destiny. When Yosef HaTzadik was primed to sin with Eishes Potiphar, what stopped him from going through with it? The Gemara in Sota tells us that that moment, he saw Dmus Diyukno Shalaviv, the image of his father, and that's what stopped him from sinning. But the Medrash records that it wasn't the mere sight of his father that prevented him from sinning. There was a conversation that happened with his father, or this representation in his mind of his father, who said to Yosef at that pivotal moment that in the future your children's names will be engraved on the ephod, and your name will be included among them. Would you prefer that your name be erased from there, and instead you'll be, you know, like every family has, that brother that the family doesn't talk about? Is that what you want to be? The one who visits the Beis Zonos rather than El HaKodesh Pnima? There are so many things that Yaakov could have said to discourage Yosef from sinning. But he brings up the ephod in particular. Mesh Chachma points out that the stones of the ephod are referred to in the Chumash as Avnei Zikaron, because they remind the Jewish people of their destiny. Those stones remind us that our destinies are bound up with each other. When a Kohen Gadol does the Avodah, he's representing all of Klal Yisrael. Yosef was saved from sinning because of the simple reminder that his destiny is the destiny of the Shifteka. that as they go, he goes. Their fate is his fate. And it's a healthy reminder. As the Jews of Israel go, we all go. There's no daylight between the ultimate destiny of the 18-year-old in Gaza and the 18-year-old in the Five Towns or West Hempstead or Teaneck. When we're unsure how to behave, as Yosef was, our guiding light, our North Star, should be the reminder that we fully connect to the rest of Klal Yisrael. It's ultimately what sets the tone for the Seder. Kol Dichvin, Kol Ditzrich. And it's only that which leads to Lashon HaBar Barad Yisrael. Rav Shimon Shkab famously, in his Hakdamat Shari Yosher, explains that, you know, a sense of selfishness is very hard to fight because, you know, it's a natural inclination for a person to be concerned about themselves and to think about themselves. So there are two mahalchim you could take. One mahalich is try to push that down, try to beat that, try to overcome that. It might be a fool's errand to do that. It's so natural to us. So Rav Shimon suggests a different mahalich based on the Mishnah. And of course I'm going to worry about ani, because that's how I'm born like that. That's my innate nature. But if I have an expanded definition of ani, and my ani doesn't just include me, it includes my wife and my children and my community and Klal Yisrael. And the bigger my ani becomes, I don't have to fight that innate desire to worry about ani, because my ani is going to be so great. A friend of mine told me that he was at the Gush dinner last week, and Rav Lichtenstein's daughter, Rabbanit Esti Rosenberg, told the story that on the morning of Shemini Atzeres, Elchanan Kalmanson was the head of the security in Otniel, and as the son of the Rosh Yeshiva Otniel, noticed, since he was head of security, he carried his phone with him, and it was ringing constantly at 7 a.m., he realized. So he went and grabbed his nephew, Menachem, and they started going into Be'eri and rescuing people. And each time they got out, someone said, "No, but I still have a brother there, go." And they kept on going back and forth and back and forth. And each time they thought they were finished, someone said, "No, I still have a brother there, I still have someone there." And they ended up saving dozens of lives over the next 24 hours of no sleep and of constant running back and forth. On what would turn out to be their last trip into Be'eri, they went into a house to rescue somebody, and they were ambushed. And Elchanan was killed on the spot, and Menachem was shot and injured. And at the Shiva for the Kalmanson family, the residents of Be'eri came to be Menachem Avel. And they said, you know, Atem Gibore Yisrael. You're the mighty ones of Israel. That you have family members that do this. And the Kalmanson family said, "We're Giborim. You're Giborim. You were hiding for 48 hours, 72 hours, couldn't move, couldn't make a sound. You're Giborim." And they said, no. "We're Giborim Bal Karchenu. We're Giborim because we had no choice but to be a Gibor. You are Giborim Bebechira. You chose, your family chose this nephew Menachem, and you chose to come in." And they said, "We chose? We're also Giborim Bal Karchenu. There was no choice. There were Jews in need. That's not a choice. The destiny of the people in Be'eri is our destiny. We understand that we're all one." You know, I hesitate to say this, but people were asking me at the beginning, first few months, after Simchas Torah, as a congregational rabbi in America, are you dealing with a lot more questions of emunah, of people struggling with emunah? And my answer was no, like not one, like not at all. The most common question I was getting was, "Rabbi, can you write a nefesh b'nefesh letter for me?" That was it. I wasn't getting questions of emunah. In the last month, it's been coming in a lot. I don't know if you have the same experience. I don't know, maybe North Woodmere is an anomaly. I don't know, or the Talmidim that I interact with. I suspect it's not an anomaly. And it occurred to me that so long as we believe in Klal Yisrael, it's much easier for us to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. That so long as there's that sense of a feeling of a shared destiny, a shared identity with Klal Yisrael, it's much easier for us to have emunah b'Hashem. When we stop believing in Hashem's people, when we start seeing those cracks again. You know, one famous spokesperson for the prime minister, who then wasn't a spokesperson and now is also kind of, I'm not sure, but he said, we hope never to go back to October 7th, but we absolutely will never go back to October 6th, to that kind of division. And while we always hoped that would be true, when we see a break in the belief in Klal Yisrael, that's where the questions of Emunah come in. The greater we're able to build in ourselves this sense of being Nose Ba'ol Im Chaveiro, by, again, point number one, Nose Ba'ol Im Chaveiro, by doing something different, by being a source of strength for other people, by having a sense of shared mission and destiny with Klal Yisrael, the greater our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be. We're not going to solve, not in the Five Towns, not in Teaneck, not in West Hempstead, we're not solving the Haredi draft issue. That's not our avoda. Our avoda is to be Nosei Ba'ol, is to do something a little bit different in our lives. Our avoda is to be a source of strength for those who are closer to the suffering. Our avoda is a sense of shared mission and a sense of shared destiny. And then Be'ezer Hashem will be zocha to see that Kala Merachim Alabrios, Merachim Min Alav, Min Hashemayim.